Welcome to the Single Greatest Choice podcast, where single women find support, empowerment, information, and inspiration around the topics of singleness, fertility, motherhood, and mindset. I'm your host, Katie B., and I'm thrilled to be back for a second season to share more stories of women like you and me who are navigating these choices, along with interviews with experts in the fields of fertility preservation, coaching, and psychology. Whether you're just starting to question what to do about your finite fertility, or whether you're ready to make the leap into solo motherhood by choice, I hope these conversations will help you to feel more supported and confident along the way. Because whatever you decide to do with these years could be the single greatest choice you'll ever make, and you don't have to make it alone. This week's story is a bit different than the ones I've covered so far on the show. I had the opportunity to talk with Maggie, who learned she had a gene mutation that put her at a significantly higher risk for both breast and ovarian cancer. So, on top of dealing with the ticking of the biological clock that we all hear to a certain extent, Maggie had even more pressing biological matters to address on her path to motherhood. To me, Maggie's story stands out because these are exactly the kinds of circumstances that can make us feel hopeless and helpless, like a victim in our own story. Unless we choose to write a different, more empowering narrative, which is exactly what Maggie has done. Listen as she shares the ups and downs of her journey in a very candid way. I hope that you'll learn from her and be inspired by how she's persevered and chosen to see the good in very challenging circumstances.
Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you. You have an angle on all of this, considering fertility and where to go with singleness and motherhood and all of that. You have just a different story that has not been told yet on the podcast. So I'm very excited to have your perspective.
I was super excited when you reached out, and I've been checking the podcast to see if anybody's had anything like this. So I'm pretty excited to share.
Thank you so much for being willing. And I guess we'll just jump right in. You can start wherever you want. Just tell us who you are and just a little bit about your story.
Sure. So Maggie, I turned 40 this summer, and that always seemed to be this giant looming number in my head of go or no go for having kids. I'd always wanted kids. I've known, I think my entire life I wanted kids, but I've always said I wanted it as part of a family unit. And it was just easy to keep that in my head that, well, if I don't end up having kids or getting into a relationship, it's fine. And maybe that's how it's meant to be. And always sort of expected that I would find somebody and end up married and then having kids and the white picket fence and all of that stuff. It obviously didn't work out that way. Cancer has always been a pretty normal word in my family. On both sides, it's impacted quite a few members of my family. Starting with my grandmother, who passed away from ovarian cancer before I was born, and she was my mom's mom. And then when I was 16, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. Went through chemo, radiation, an amazingly strong woman, worked the entire time. My parents had divorced, so she was a single mom raising three girls and going through cancer treatment. Came through it. Her sister was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, went through two rounds of that. Another brother of hers had squamous cell cancer. They all went through it and were fine. And then fast forward maybe 15 years to 2010, my mom was diagnosed again with breast cancer. And it was a different kind of cancer, which is pretty unusual. So it was at that point that we realized that there might be a genetic predisposition in our family. Similar to the first time, her sister, the one who'd had Hodgkin's disease twice, was then diagnosed with breast cancer. And her other brother was diagnosed with prostate cancer. So my Aunt Kay went ahead and had genetic testing done to see if she had the BRCA gene mutation, which is the breast cancer gene. And there's two breast cancer genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And at that time, this was, I think, 2011, 2012, there wasn't a whole lot of genetic testing happening. So it was pretty expensive. Her results, I was able to use and go meet with a geneticist, and it came back positive that I had the BRCA1 mutation. I really thought I was going to be negative. I don't know why. I had a 50% chance of having the gene mutation, and I was convinced I wasn't going to have it. but myself and my sister, Vicky, both tested positive. My sister Anne tested negative for the mutation. Most of the cousins also tested negative. I have a bit of a strange family in that my mom and her sister married my dad and his brother.
Oh, wow.
So two sisters married two brothers. So we grew up with their children, who are my double cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin Chrissy was also positive for the gene mutation. So what that meant is that we have about an 87% chance over our lifetime of getting breast cancer and about a 60% chance of getting ovarian cancer. And that's over the entire lifetime, right? So it means that we're considered high risk, obviously, and have to get a lot of surveillance. I had my first mammogram on my 30th birthday, which is a little early, but that's what it dictates for being high risk. And they immediately found something and I had to have a biopsy, which was terrifying. And it came back as nothing. But for me, getting that positive for the BRCA1 mutation result really set off 6 years of hell, frankly, mm-hmm. in which the only thing I focused on personally was how to not get cancer and what happens when I do get cancer. I had to get an MRI or a mammogram every 6 months. I had to get transvaginal ultrasounds every 6 months and blood tests to check for ovarian cancer. And it was all I could think about. So I started thinking a little bit more about whether or not kids would be in my future, and knowing that one of the ways that I could help reduce my risk for breast cancer is to actually take my ovaries out. And I'd always said, you know what, I'll make the decision when I'm 40, because at that point, I probably won't have a good chance of getting pregnant anyways. And that's my deciding factor. And mm-hmm. it always felt like that was so far away.
Gosh, I cannot imagine. I mean, many of us listening are familiar with a certain ticking clock of biology, but you really had two going on simultaneously mm-hmm. that were really competing in terms of what was going to be asked of your body. And I can't imagine functioning in that circumstance. Were you, when you went in for the genetic testing, I don't know a whole lot about the BRCA1 and BRCA2, but it does feel like a relatively new science that we're even aware that there is a genetic link and being able to identify it. Was that new information to you, that breast cancer could even be genetic and that you potentially were someone that had those genes? Or had you kind of known for many years that it could be a genetic part of your makeup?
I think we had a good idea, because the sheer volume of people in my mom's family that had cancer, mm-hmm. that there had to be some sort of link. I remember my dad always thought it was because they grew up in a very industrial city, mm-hmm. And that he thought it had some connection there. But yeah, I don't think the BRCA gene was identified until the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
Don't quote me on that. But yeah, so it was a relatively new thing. But I think my family sort of always knew. I mean, even apart from my grandmother, there were others in the family that had cancer. So it's just something that we grew up with. We all just sort of assumed we were going to be at high risk as well.
Gosh, it's tough.
Yeah.
So you said 40 was kind of your cutoff when you knew that you were going to do some medical preventing of, you know, allowing a cancer to develop. And remind us again, how old were you when you found out that you were a carrier of the gene?
I was 32 when I found out.
Okay. So in that time in between, what did life look like? Were you dating? Were you, I mean, other than obviously the panic of the situation, mm-hmm. what else was happening?
Yeah. No, I dated, nothing seriously. I was in a long-term relationship in my 20s and was engaged, and I'm very grateful that that didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
So I had on and off relationships in my early 30s. But I also didn't try very hard. And I don't know if that's related to the screenings for cancer and anything, or just I don't enjoy dating.
Yeah. Really well, don't. No one told us we were going to have to try really hard, right? Right. Like, it doesn't seem like a thing you'd have to try really hard to do.
No.
So yeah, I totally get that. There's other friends and career and travel and, you know, all the other things. And
yeah,
especially when you don't enjoy it.
Yeah. And I have an amazing group of friends, an amazing family. I love my job. And so it was always, I just sort of felt if it was going to happen, it would happen. Mm-hmm. And if it didn't happen, it wasn't going to happen. And so I stopped putting so much pressure on myself to try to do the online dating where it just felt incredibly uncomfortable and wasn't mm-hmm. my thing. If it's going to happen, it'll happen. And, you know, mm-hmm. I know some of it is how much I put into it, but mm-hmm. I recognize that.
Yeah. Nobody says you have to put everything into it. And you know what? I put everything into it for a long stretch of time and we're sitting in the same place. So,
right.
You know,
right.
Yeah. I'm not sure the effort alone exactly. would have made a difference.
yeah, exactly.
So at what point was there a turning point from kind of awareness of this genetic predisposition to actually taking some action? And tell us more about what you've done to prevent cancer.
Sure. So I proceeded with all my screenings and just, I had a really great team up in Baltimore. My cousin was going to the same place and really felt like they were doing a good job. But as I started to get a little older, I would find new lumps in my breasts. I ended up being in there pretty much every 3 months to get either a mammogram or have the doctor feel something. I had another couple of biopsies when something suspicious popped up. And I think the last straw was I had a beautiful giant cyst. And when the radiologist told me that it was just a big, beautiful cyst, I started to cry. And it wasn't because it wasn't cancer and I was happy. It was because it wasn't cancer and I had to go back to waiting for when I was going to get cancer. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "Why don't you do something about it?" And I was like, I was so offended. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, it's such an easy decision to do that, to have a double mastectomy or, you know, take my ovaries out. And so I left that appointment feeling very angry, but then also realizing that I was massively depressed. I suspect because a lot of the stress I put myself under from having to go in and do all these screenings every 3 months. And then 3 weeks later, my cousin, my double cousin, was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's a year older than me. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the decision was made. And I said, yep, that's it. I'm done. Why am I doing this to myself? It was a little tough because I knew that making that decision to have a preventative double mastectomy meant that I would never get to experience breastfeeding. And that was pretty important to me. But I knew it was the time and I knew I had to do it. And it ended up in my follow-up appointment from that big, beautiful cyst. They found something on the other side. It turned out to be atypical ductal hyperplasia, which is basically the cells starting to form in a non-normal way, mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean it would turn into cancer, but there's also a chance it would have. So I had that removed in early April of 2018. And then I spent basically the rest of 2018 getting my body ready to have this surgery. I feel very fortunate that I was able to pick my surgery date and time, where a lot of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer, they don't, right?
Right.
They
just have to emergency.
Immediately right. go in to do it. So I'm very thankful and grateful that I was able to take control of those decisions. One of my best friends is a strength training coach. And so I started powerlifting, which was fantastic. Then I had my surgery in November of 2018.
And as you were prepping for the surgery, and it sounds like there were a number of months in there where you knew the surgery was coming and you were getting yourself ready, were doctors talking with you about what this meant fertility-wise? Or were they more focused on keeping you alive?
Right.
Were you getting guidance on that? Or were they just like, you know, let's prevent cancer at all costs?
not really. I mean, it was the matter of fact, like you won't be able to breastfeed, obviously, but there wasn't anything about fertility. And even going to speak with my regular gynecologist, afterwards, she was like, oh, I'm not worried about the ovarian cancer risk. And I was like, well, gosh, I mean, I am.
Right.
But maybe if she's not, and she just always said, look, when you want to have a kid, let me know, you know, we'll start the process. Mm-hmm. But until you know that's what you want to do. And in the back of my mind, I thought, well, when I get to 40, I always felt like I could put off making this decision mm-hmm. because I think it was too hard to truly sit down and think, what am I going to do if I have to make this decision? Or if I were to get ovarian cancer, I need to think about this. But I kept putting it off and saying, I'll make the decision when I'm 40, because mm-hmm. that was just easier at the time. Mm-hmm. And then I turned 40.
I hate how that always happens.
I kept trying to stop it, but somehow it snuck up on me. The recovering from the mastectomy took quite a while. It's a pretty massive surgery. And there were a few surgeries afterwards to exchange my expanders for implants. And then I had another revision surgery. And so all that time, it was mostly just focused on keeping my body healthy and work. And mm-hmm. that was pretty much it. My sister also had a preventive double mastectomy. And then she decided that same year to go ahead and take out her ovaries and uterus. She had two kids and she was done. So she figured, met my deductible, might as well do it. And when she did that, they actually discovered that she actually already had ovarian cancer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, at 41. So that was another wake up call. And I finally said, you know what, Maggie, you have to go see a gynecological oncologist. And I knew exactly what he was going to say as soon as I went in there. It was, you need to take your ovaries out. Mm-hmm. Especially with how young both my cousin and my sister were when they were diagnosed. There's not a whole heck of a lot of research, but in my family, you can see each generation, it's gotten about 10 years younger from the mm-hmm. time of diagnosis. So,
was there any conversation or consideration of trying to get pregnant prior to any of these surgeries? Was that on your radar or your doctor's?
So it was with the gynecological oncologist. He said, I think what you should do before you make this decision is go meet with a fertility specialist, figure out what the art of the possible is, right? You're 40. So at that point we knew, you know, my follicle count was probably low, but I didn't know what like my FSH and all those other fancy numbers were. Mm-hmm. So I went and did that. And it was pretty eye-opening. I don't think any of my levels were considered normal. And my follicle count was like 3. So it was going to be really, really difficult to do it naturally. And so I talked with the fertility specialist about what my options were. And
did they think there was any link between the genetic predisposition and where you were fertility-wise? Or is that just two different pieces of bad luck?
Yeah. And I didn't even know until I met with a fertility specialist that having a BRCA1 mutation actually impacts your ovarian reserve and you wow. have a reduced ovarian reserve. And that was the first time I'd heard that.
Right. That should definitely be out there for women who are yeah. 18, 19, 20 and know mm-hmm. that they could be BRCA positive. You know, that's good information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I knew at that point that it was fish or cut bait time. So I knew I would have the option for donor embryo. So I set up some appointments with the fertility center just to get the lay of the land and figure out what my options would be. And then it was really just a lot of internal thinking and trying to make a decision about what I wanted to do. And I realized that I wish I had made this decision a decade sooner. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, I want kids. And of course, I'm blessed to have an amazing family and great group of friends who will support me in this. And why was I so terrified to make this decision? And at that point, it was just full steam ahead. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the order of operations there? Like, were you planning to have your ovaries removed first and then try to get pregnant with donor embryo?
Yeah. So since I wasn't going to use my own eggs, they wanted to go ahead and take the ovaries out first, just to get that over with and make sure that there was no cancer there. Mm-hmm. So I had that surgery at the end of October of last year, and the pathology came back clear. Everything looked good. And then 6 weeks later, I got started on the process for choosing a donor embryo and getting all the fun tests and all of that.
Wow. Some listeners may need a little bit of a science lesson or reminder about just kind of the general process. You don't need your ovaries if the embryo is already created. The ovaries are really just to produce the egg. You were kind of skipping the step of needing your ovaries. So you still have a functional uterus and cervix and, you know, all the things that you would need to carry a baby, just not the eggs, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Gosh, so cool what science can do.
Really, really is.
Kudos to you for just making it through all of this with your sanity intact. And it sounds like you're, you know, relatively positive and, you know, looking forward to the future and all of that. Cause really, I mean, these are the types of things that we can just allow to completely wreck us. And I'm sure you've had your ups and downs, but to even be moving forward in the way that you are is really inspiring and amazing. And glad that people are getting to hear your story.
I mean, I do feel pretty fortunate in that I have my two sisters who I don't think we go 4 hours without talking to each other. And then to have two best friends who have gone through the fertility process and are going through it again. And to have that resource to be able to ask questions, they know exactly what I'm going through. I can talk to them about any of it, all the terrible stuff, all the uncomfortable stuff, like, you know, learning to give myself shots in my butt. and how do you do that when you're, you know, I'm left-handed? How do I do it on my right side without stabbing my hand?
Right. Yeah. You and I talked a little bit before we started recording about just, you know, how important community is. And really, I mean, you've got so many different kind of coinciding things going that, you know, there's the single mother by choice community that I'm sure has been really important for you to hear those stories. And then there's the medical community of other people who've experienced breast cancer or BRCA or, you know, different things like that. And then the fertility, and it sounds like your friends are coupled, right? Your two close friends.
Yes. Yeah.
And yet IVF is IVF, whether you're coupled or not. And they know how to do the butt shots.
Exactly.
They know how to do this thing. So really amazing how all of that kind of coincides and you've been able to find support and community in all of those various places.
And, you know, they start to overlap too. So the community that I found after having my preventative mastectomy was a group called the Breasties. So it's a national organization for women previvors, which is what I would be considered, having a genetic predisposition to cancer and having the preventative surgeries, but also for women in active treatment or survivors. And we created a DC chapter of the Breasties a couple months after my mastectomy. And the community that has brought is amazing. There've been a few women that have had children after surviving breast cancer. And so to be able to talk through, you know, those things with not being able to breastfeed, and that's been incredibly helpful. And then there's another organization called the Previvor. The woman who runs that, Alan Rose, is actually pregnant right now. And so she's documented a lot of her journey on social media and through their website. Again, it's just to be able to feel like you can relate to somebody else going through something that you're going through and say, okay, yeah, I am normal. This is normal, has just been really helpful for me.
It makes me so happy. The fact that women are becoming more and more comfortable and open with sharing really vulnerable parts of their lives online. Because the women that I know who are single mothers by choice or who have dealt with some of the same big questions I have, I know them because I met them online for the most part. So even if we've connected now in real life, it started online. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me so happy that for younger women who are going to find out in the next few years that they are predisposed to breast cancer, that they are genetic carriers of the BRCA gene, that they can put in a hashtag and find you and this woman that you're talking about who's currently pregnant and all of these different stories. And so in that moment of being hit with this terrifying news, they immediately get to see, and women survive this, and women go on to become mothers, and women still have all of the things that they want in life, despite having this terrible bad luck or however you want to think of it. That's amazing.
Yeah. I, in some ways, feel very grateful for having this mutation and being able to then share my experiences with it. And now to be able to share this part of it, I post on the first of every month as a reminder for women to do a self-breast exam and men too. And I've gotten a lot of messages from people either commenting on them or just reaching out to me privately to say how much that's helped them and that they are now regular in their self-breast exams. You just don't know how much you might impact somebody else by telling your story.
Definitely. So tell us more about where you are with Single Mother by Choice journey.
So I really had no idea what to expect once I'd made the decision. And the folks at the Fertility Center were amazing in answering all of my questions. I had to wait 6 weeks after my surgery before they could actually check my uterus and make sure everything looked good. Once I did some blood work, they gave me access to the donor database. And that was difficult. I don't know what I expected. There was not this massive amount of donor embryos to pick from. Mm-hmm. I looked for health indicators in both the sperm donor and egg donor. At least 3/4 of the available donor embryos probably had some sort of red flag for me. Mm-hmm. It became a bit obsessive with hitting refresh on the donor embryo list for a new one to come on. Mm-hmm. And it was like a week before Thanksgiving. I was at my sister's. I had it pulled up. Both my sisters had my login so that they were looking all the time too. And I found one and it was great. And I knew that they took the access to the database away once you made a selection. So I was taking pictures with my phone of all of the information because in my mind, I don't know why I didn't think that they would send me the report. And then when I went to reserve the embryo, it was gone.
Oh no.
And I was devastated. So I kept up with refreshing every hour. And it was the day after Thanksgiving. I was in bed in the morning and I was like, surely nobody's going to be adding new embryos the day after Thanksgiving, but I'll just go ahead and check. And there was a double donor embryo that showed up. And I looked at it. I sent it to my sisters. We looked at it really quick. Everything looked amazing. And so I reserved it.
When you say double donor, does that mean, I'm assuming most of the embryos you were looking at were like a couple who was going through IVF and then they had more embryos than what they needed. And so this was a sperm donor and an egg donor, like not a couple.
Yeah. It was a couple who neither of which could conceive naturally. And so they selected a sperm donor and an egg donor and had a batch of embryos.
So that's, you get the premium genes that way.
Yes.
It's not just two people who love each other and want to make a baby. It's two people who've been screened for genetics.
Yep.
There are pros to using donors for sure.
Yes. And this one, the embryo had the PGS or PGT testing done on it. Mm-hmm. So I knew it was a healthy embryo.
And was it just one embryo or was there a cohort of embryos?
So there was two, but you can only, the fertility center that I'm using, you can only reserve one embryo at a time.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. What if you wanted to have more than one child? They don't let you reserve?
No.
Wow. I did not know that. That is interesting information. I guess I've heard other stories of women. I'm thinking of one woman who was on the podcast last season who had, I think, several donor embryos, but she got them from an individual, I think, not from a fertility center.
Yeah. At first, I didn't really even think about it. Now, as I'm, a few months further in the process, thinking, well, gosh, I don't know that I only want one. But then, I also think I really wanted to be a mom and to have a kid. Mm-hmm. And to me, the genetics or genetic makeup of that child mattered less to me than being able to be a mom.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So although it would be nice, because this one did have two embryos, to have them be full siblings, I'm also okay with, if I decide to have a second, then going back to the donor embryo database and seeing what's available.
Yeah. One of my closest friends, who's been just incredible through my whole fertility process, has three children. Her children are older. They're in their teens and 20s now, but all three adopted from different countries and just, you know, entirely different stories and backgrounds. And you watch them interact as siblings, and they're like very much siblings. Zero genetics shared by anyone under that roof, but you know, they are, it's very much, they love on each other like siblings.
Yeah,
it has a lot more to do with how you're raised and all of that than genetics.
Exactly. Yeah. So I made the selection, which felt very much like Tinder for embryos.
And that was Thanksgiving this year that we just had.
Yes. And so I scheduled my HSG test for the first day that my surgeon cleared me. And then because I don't have any hormones in my body, there's no cycle that I have to be matched up against. So I can essentially start a frozen embryo transfer cycle at any point because I don't produce any estrogen right now.
Whoa, hold on. I've got so many questions about this. Okay. The first question that I had was the HSG. I thought the purpose of that, and maybe it's just one of several purposes, was to see if your tubes are open.
In theory, that's what it is.
But you have
but I think tubes? It's also to, I have no tubes.
Right.
Okay. That's, but also to check.
Confused me.
Yeah. Check the shape of your uterus, I think.
Okay. That makes sense. Cause they kind of fill it up with saline dye situation, and then they can see, I guess, like polyps, or some people have, I think it's called like a bicoronated uterus where there's like a septum between. Okay. So that makes sense. So they were checking out the kind of the structure of your uterus. And then, okay, talk to us about the hormones, because I guess I'm ignorant about, I know some hormones are produced actually in the ovaries, and it sounds like that's the estrogen, and then some are in the pituitary, like in the brain.
Right.
Okay. So tell us more about.
But without the, and to be honest, I don't know where progesterone comes from.
I don't either. I thought it was the brain, but maybe it all has to kind of talk to each other, and without one component, cell phone carrier, and there's no tower, and there's just like, there's nothing for it to ping off of or something.
Exactly. Like there's no, with no estrogen, there's no egg being produced, which I think would stimulate, I don't know if it's the FSH, which I think is in your brain, or the, can't think of the other one. But generally, since they didn't have to track anything to my ovulation, since I didn't ovulate anymore, you know, when I talked to the doctors about it, they said, yeah, the good thing is you pick a date.
So you got to choose the timing, and then were they giving you synthetic estrogen, or is estrogen just not? All of a sudden, I'm like, my mind is being blown right now about like, wait, what is actually needed to carry a baby? I don't know.
Yeah. So they did a mock transfer. So just like saline sonogram mid-December. And since everything looked good there, they started me the next day on estrogen 3 times a day, and progesterone I started right around the new year.
Okay. So that sounds actually really similar to a lot of women that aren't in the same circumstance. Was it injections of estrogen or oral or patches?
It's an injection every 3 days. And then the miserable suppositories 2 times a day.
So many of us have been there.
It's pretty awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I try not to complain too much about it because it's for a good thing.
Yes. So did you do all the medication with your mock transfer as well, or just after?
Well, so just the mock transfer, and then they, on like the 16th of December, and then they started me on all the medicine.
Okay. Right after.
On the 17th. Okay. And then I did my frozen embryo transfer on January 4th.
Okay. So I wasn't sure if you wanted to talk about this, but let's talk about it, and then you can decide later if you want to cut any of it out. But okay. So we are recording on January 15th. Mm-hmm. And so you did a transfer on January 4th. Okay. So you're technically in the 2-week wait. How have you been feeling? Like, what's the 2-week wait been like for you?
It has been difficult. So the actual transfer was pretty anticlimactic, you know, with COVID protocols and everything. It was in and out. Mm-hmm. We did all the superstitions, the eating pineapple core and getting McDonald's French fries afterwards. And I took a couple of days off of work to just chill out. And it's been fine. I knew I wasn't going to be able to wait the full 2 weeks without doing a home pregnancy test.
Woman after my own heart. I don't know if you've heard my stories, but yes. I never wait. Never.
It's not in my nature. Uh-huh. And actually, through talking to you, it made so much sense to have to wait those 2 weeks for me personally. And I know it's different for everybody, but for me personally, to have to wait those 2 weeks and then to go in and have a negative, I think that just would have been so incredibly hard. And I just wanted to know every single day. And my sisters were texting me every day, have you tested? Have you tested? But then they're like, it's too early. Don't test. Have you tested? Just kidding. And so I tested the Saturday after. So my transfer was on a Tuesday and I was like, oh, what the heck? I'll test that Saturday. And of course it was negative. And I was fine with it. I really didn't expect anything. So the next day I got up at like 6 a.m. and I had to use the bathroom and I was like, oh, I know this means I should test. And so I did, but I didn't like turn on any lights. I put it on my nightstand and I got back in bed. But then I was like, oh, I guess it's been 3 minutes. All the lights are off. I grabbed the test and I thought I saw a line. And so I jumped out of bed. I went and like opened my blinds, turned on all the lights. Texted my sister. I was like, are you awake? And there was a line and she was like, go out and get a digital test.
And this is how many days post transfer is this?
6 days post transfer.
Okay.
And so I went and got a digital test and sure enough, it said pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
And so I've done a test every day since then just to validate that I'm not crazy, which maybe makes me crazy.
Oh my gosh. I've showed a couple of people. Actually, I think I posted it to Instagram, but I showed my doctor my photograph of all of my line progressions. Yes. And she was like, oh girl. And I was like, oh, that's like a third of the ones I actually took.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Mine at day 6 post-transfer was still like white as snow. So that I know some people get it as early as like 4 days, but mine, it was really like day 8, I think, when it started to show up. But
yeah, I was not expecting it at all. And it's,
okay, so line is still getting darker? Where like,
so I have a bunch of different kinds of tests. So I used the digital ones first, and then now I'm going to the ones where the line should be darkening because I wanted to give myself a couple days since it was so early. Mm-hmm. So this morning it was definitely darker. So my blood test is next Tuesday, the 19th. So I'm going to do the line test this weekend.
That feels like a really long time between your transfer and your beta test.
It's like 2 weeks and a day. And part of that's just because Monday's a holiday.
Right. See, mine would have fallen. I think my 2 weeks would have fallen on a Sunday. So they went ahead and let me come in the Friday before, but mine was definitely way less than 2 weeks.
I was really hoping they were going to have me come in the Friday before.
Yeah. And, you know, the trade-off for that was I got my beta early, so I didn't have to wait as long. But my first beta was 36, which was low. And I had a chemical pregnancy before. And so there was a part of me that was like, okay, well, I still don't know. I went in 4 days later and it was 360. So it was still low, but it was like, it had done more than double. And at that point, we're like, okay, this is going in the right direction.
Right. But,
so it's like, pros and cons. I mean, the waiting sucks, but even with the number, sometimes you're still kind of waiting a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
That's all very exciting and promising and heading in the right direction.
Yes. Feeling cautiously optimistic at this point.
Yes. In your day-to-day world, does everybody know you're doing this? Do not a lot of people know you're doing this?
Not a lot of people know. My two sisters, my two best friends, and my two closest coworkers. During COVID times, we are on video chat most of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes you have to tell work people just because otherwise they think something's horribly wrong. Like you can't keep going to the doctor without an explanation.
Why do you have so many doctor's appointments, Maggie?
Well, especially with your history, you want to make sure that they know you're okay.
I've been pretty open about all of my, whether it was surgeries, and I feel like being pretty open about this, but I think for me, the next step is telling my mom, which I think I'll do, assuming all goes well on Tuesday when I get the results. And then I feel like it becomes real.
Real, yes. And we won't air this until after, until after your mom knows. So exciting. Will people be surprised when you kind of go public with this, which, you know, could be, I don't know what your plan is, but a lot of people wait for a while. How do you think that will be received in your social circle in general?
I think everyone's going to be incredibly confused. How did this happen? Didn't you just take your ovaries out? So I think people are going to be surprised. I think they're going to be incredibly surprised, but I really think everybody is going to be thrilled. Cousins and my nieces and nephews, mm-hmm. I have a gazillion of them. They don't know yet. And I think I'm going to do a scavenger hunt for some that live right here, just because I'm so close with all of them. So I want to make sure that I'm involving them in
all
of this.
That's so exciting. I love that so much. My experience has been, number one, so much support. And I knew that people would be, I guess my expectation was just that like people weren't going to be ugly or judgy to mm-hmm. my face, but I've been overwhelmed by how much people have gone out of their way to be supportive, just in comments and messages and things like that. And then the other thing is people really don't give a shit like what you're doing in your life. Like I was so worried about coming out at work as a single mom. Like I was so worried that people would think it was an accident or I just like hooked up with some dude or, you know, I really wanted to kind of like control the narrative. But the way that I told a large group of people at work, cause I train teachers. And so there are like, you know, 100 people that would email me asking for answers. And when I'm out on maternity leave, I kind of needed them to know that I was going out.
Yeah.
So told all these people, and I got an email the other day from someone just unrelated, like asking a work question. And then she was like, I hope you're feeling well and make sure you get that husband rubbing your feet. I loved foot rubs when I was pregnant. And I was like, oh, they totally don't even know I'm single. Like they it's like, right. These people don't care what's going on in my life. What's relevant to them is starting in April, I'm not going to return your emails.
They don't I think I probably still have a bit of that fear of how people are going to react. I mean, I think that's something probably through all things in life about the judgment that you might get from people. Mm-hmm. But I think like you said, when I'm hoping it's me worrying about it and that when it actually happens, I really can't see people being judgy. But again, until I'm through it, I feel like I'm still in the back of my mind going to have this little bit of, how do I tell everybody that I'm doing this on my own? Do I need to tell everybody that I'm doing mm-hmm. this on my own? Is it really anybody else's business?
How do you feel like your medical history affects that, if at all? Because I know like in this community of single mothers by choice, people really fixate on what other people are going to think and what, you know, all of that. But having the opportunity taken away from you from something completely outside of your control biologically, do you think that makes it easier or do you feel like you struggle with all the same things?
You know, I mean, I feel like it's made it easier. Again, I think I said it earlier, but I feel really grateful for having this mutation because I think it's allowed me to be a lot more decisive in my life and in just how I come to decisions. And I got a tattoo on my back after my mastectomy with a DNA strand and then a quote from Hamilton, which says, I am the one thing in life I can control. Mm-hmm. And that quote to me is so powerful because I feel like I was able to make these decisions to prevent this horrible disease. And I'm so grateful that I was able to do that. And that it's really made me just realize how grateful I am for that. And that I can do hard things and mm-hmm. I can make hard decisions. And that the fact that I can't breastfeed and that I don't have ovaries any longer. And here I am pregnant.
Right. I know. I'm actually like, as you were talking, I was getting very teary eyed thinking about what a gift you've made out of some real shitty circumstances, but also the gift that you will be able to pass to your child. Just having that mindset and that outlook in life of like, I am in control of my choices and I get to kind of write my own story. And I can't imagine who I'd be if I understood that from day one. It took me 40 years to really take ownership of my own life.
Yes. And
like what we're going to be able to give our children and to be able to share your story. And I mean, you know, just from the time they're little, and mommy, what's that on your back? And like talking to your child about what you've been through at various age appropriate stages. What an inspiration. Like what an incredible mommy you're going to be. I'm so happy for your child.
Yeah. That's the only thing I kick myself on is I wish I had done all this sooner, but I also, you know, I'm not somebody who believes that everything happens for a reason. In fact, I'm firmly against that, but I do think that these experiences have made me so much stronger of a person and so much better of a person that I do wish I had done it earlier in life, mm-hmm. only to hopefully have realized this sooner, but maybe I wouldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I did it at the time I was supposed mm-hmm. to.
Yeah. I'm totally on the same page with you. And it ticks people off sometimes. Everything happens for a reason does not resonate with me, but I very much believe I can find the reason in anything that happens to me.
Yeah.
It's a decision to frame it in a way that leads to positive movement instead of getting sucked into the cycle of negativity. So one of my favorite quotes, it's Elizabeth Gilbert. Do you know who I'm talking about? The
Eat, Pray, Love.
Yes. So I had this quote on my mirror for the longest time. It said, I've never heard of a major life transformation that didn't start with someone finally getting tired of their own bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. That quote has given me so much permission when I have that feeling of, I wish I would have, or I should have, or I knew better. Or it's like, you know, I just wasn't tired of the bullshit yet. Like it didn't hurt bad enough for me to take action. And until it did, I wasn't going to take action. There has to be that tipping point. And every minute up until that tipping point happens, like you're just not ready. And mm-hmm. so it's just not beneficial, I don't think, to look back and wish that, you know, yeah, sure, you could have done things. I mean, I think about that with like freezing eggs. Yeah, but I wasn't $10,000 motivated to freeze eggs until the day that I was, you know?
Yeah.
And yes, I could have gotten more eggs earlier, but like earlier, I didn't have the fire behind it that made me feel like it was something that needed to be done. And so the very first day that I got tired of the bullshit, the suffering of what if I don't do this and what if it's the worst mistake I ever made, it had to get to that point before I could do it. And so I think, you know, letting yourself off the hook for you made moves when you were ready to make moves. And the day before you made the move, you weren't ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a friend send an email to a few of us at work last week that really stuck with me. And it was after everything that happened at the Capitol, but talking about having empathy and compassion for others, she said, what I realized is that the person I needed to be giving empathy and compassion to was myself. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't thinking about that. That really resonated with me and thought, okay, I could have done this 10 years sooner. I could have done this, but I didn't. And to your point, I don't think it was until I hit those tipping points for either my medical decisions or deciding to become a mom, mm-hmm. that I would have felt ready to do it.
Mm-hmm. And it's so easy when we hear someone else's story to have compassion. To your point, it makes total sense to me why you wouldn't have made moves earlier. We would never say to a friend or an acquaintance, well, you idiot, you should have done that way earlier. You know, like right. We would never, but we say that to ourselves, you know?
Yes,
but like when
yes.
you're hearing the story from the outside, mm-hmm. it makes sense because it's easier, I think, to be compassionate and understanding and kind of suspend judgment when it's not ourselves. And I think that's a uniquely female, I don't know, men do it too, but I think that women are just very, very prone to that lack of self-compassion.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I do definitely want to make sure that you have an opportunity to whatever your soapbox is, which I can imagine that you have one in terms of preventative care and all those things we were just talking about, not going back and beating ourselves up. But now that you know, what are the things that you wish you had known?
Now that I know, the things I wish I had known were that I can do hard things, that I really think knowing is half the battle. It's probably more than half the battle. I lived in a bit of la-la land, and that if I didn't think about it too hard, I didn't have to deal with it. But, you know, I probably had several years after finding out about my mutation that I could have frozen my eggs. But to be able to learn about what all of my options were, I didn't even hear the word donor embryo until last year. If I had known more about that and maybe looked for more of a community sooner, I think I might have made the decision sooner. I don't know. I also think it terrifies me sometimes to reach out on these social media sites or groups, but everyone that I have reached out on, I've found such an amazing group of people listening to podcasts like this or talking to, you know, my DC breasties. You have the same questions. And mm-hmm. So it's just been so helpful to me to ask the questions when you have them and know that you're in a safe place where people are experiencing the same thing as you. And then I think the only thing I would say about the genetics is that it's still relatively new and there's new gene mutations being found all the time. It isn't just BRCA1 and BRCA2 anymore. And so I would just encourage everybody to know what their risk is, check their family history, talk to your doctor, see if they think there's a good reason to get genetic testing. Mm-hmm. I don't think everybody needs it, but I do know people that have had, you know, no history of cancer in their family, and yet they have a genetic mutation or were diagnosed with cancer and then found they had a genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. So just making sure you know what your risk is. And then you can be empowered to make decisions.
So if people are interested in getting in touch with you, would you like for them to contact me and I can put them in touch with you? Or would you like to share your Instagram or anything like that? It's totally up to you.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with sharing my Instagram. People should feel free to reach out to me. It's M as in Maggie Wilson 102.
Okay, and I'll put it in the show notes as well. Well, thank you so much for being willing to share your story. And I'm so inspired by you and also just so thrilled for what's next for you. And so glad that you have so many different supportive communities that no matter what's ahead, you're going to have people surrounding you who can support you and care about you. And I'm so excited for your impending, you know, you get your test. We're just days away from the
days
first
away.
Gosh, having just been there, like it, and then it's on to the next milestone and the next milestone and the next milestone.
I know.
But eventually you get to where I am and there's like someone tap dancing on your bladder and you're like, I think this is going to actually end up being a baby that's born. Like, I think for real guys, like I think it's going to happen.
I'm just going to follow your Instagram then and make sure and know, so I know exactly what's coming next for me.
Yes. Well, best of luck to you. And thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm excited to get this conversation out there.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Single Greatest Choice podcast. I'm your host, Katie B. You can learn more about me, this podcast, and the Single Greatest Choice coaching at my website, www.singlegreatestchoice.com, or find me on Instagram at single_greatest_choice. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a minute to rate and review in iTunes. That helps more women to find our show. Until next time, I'm sending you all of my love and support as you go about making the choices that will create a life you love.